Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is George Saunders, who has a new collection of short stories, 10th of December. George Saunders is the author of, I think, six collections of fiction, one collection of essays, and a couple of the stories have popped up as separate books as well. 10th of December has taken things to a whole different level. This is almost expected, but probably not.
Not expected. When I finished, I thought, well, this is, you know, my fourth collection, kind of a, you know, expansion along the same lines. But the other ones did never really sell like this, so that was a big surprise. I think you could make a nice linear chart of the books as being one leading to the next very logically and everything.
George Saunders, what I noticed in reading these stories, and it separates them out because I've never encountered this before, is I would sit down with a story, get 7, 8, 10 pages into it, and suddenly go, you know, I have no idea what I've just read, and I'm lost, at which point I go back to the beginning, my focus shifts, and suddenly the story makes sense.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't heard that before. That's an interesting. Is it that you're reading more closely, or you've gotten enough to sort of?
I think it's that the stream of consciousness gets me lost, but then when I go back, suddenly it clicks.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I never even really thought up this principle. What I do sort of automatically is try to have a tick of trying to eliminate the cushioning or the comforting material. So, for example, if the first story in the book is a real intense stream of consciousness thing, and in some early drafts, it kind of said, you know, something like in a suburban house, there was a young woman, you know, which somehow offends me. I don't know why it offends me, but I took all that out, all the kind of standard introductory stuff, and just dropped it into her head right away. And that pleases me. And I think it's probably one of the reasons that it sometimes is difficult to get bite the first time. But to me, it's kind of worth it because I'm trying to simulate her thoughts. And in her thought stream, she's not thinking once upon a time there was a suburban girl in a house. She's just thinking. So it's kind of a trade-off. You know, I have a real pedigree in minimalism. That was my first love. And I think it's some manifestation of that impulse, I think. Ever since I was a little kid, I kind of cringed at what I thought of as banal sentences, like in our reading books in school, you know, like the stuff that said, Jim was a happy young boy who lived on Scarlet Avenue. I just thought, eh. But then I read Esther Forbes, Johnny Tremaine, and she doesn't do that very much. Every sentence counts with her. So I think that is a tick or a passion of mine, is to try to get the sentences to do as much work as they can. And the stuff that sounds like it could be anybody else writing, I just sort of have an aversion to it. In all those stories, I will have had something more user-friendly at some point. And I think I'm just taking a gamble that if I trim that off and you have to work a little harder, then we're suddenly relating at a higher level because I've assumed the best of you and you've risen to the occasion and now we're off to the races. And what we lose is the kind of, I would call it kind of conventional literary language, you know.
It would make sense then that the stories wind up as short stories rather than novels. That's because right. You're not trying to be expansive. You're bringing it in.
That's right. And also, I think, you know, to be honest, I even reading my own work, I think this technique we're talking about has a tendency to wear a reader out. After 15 pages of it, you need a little bit of a break. So it's kind of it's maybe like a thrash band. I mean, after you can only take that in short bursts. You know, 8 or 9 hours of that would be too much. So one of the costs of this extreme minimalism or whatever you want to call it is that the goal is a lot of intensity, a lot of emotion, a lot of drama, and then sheesh, you know. So I've had the experience of reading some of my books cover to cover and feeling like after some point it didn't cohere. You had to really take a break in between stories. It's a trade-off.
That's what I found I had to do, is that when I tried reading multiple stories, I'd go, no, I can't do this,
right,
and then I'd have to
exactly.
Shut the book.
Yeah. I think I almost was, you know, trying to think of some mechanical way to enforce that, but I don't think maybe, you know, some kind of electric shock thing that's built into the book or something.
George Saunders, Escape from Spiderhead, I believe, was originally a longer story. Is that correct?
All of my stories were originally longer stories. They were all originally novels, and they shrunk.
I believe your comment about that was the stories in the book were novels before they came to their senses.
Yeah. My whole approach is kind of intuitive and iterative. So I start, hopefully, with almost nothing idea, just a little fragment that's interesting. Then just start kind of kicking it, you know, by revision. And it starts to grow. And then it starts to actually seem like a story. But at some point, let's say it's 30 pages. Then in rereading it, you think there's something leisurely about this. There's something that isn't kind of cutting to the chase. And there's just usually one kind of catastrophic day where I go, and pare it back. So I think my aesthetic, maybe it's neurological, but my aesthetic is basically alive when I'm trying to reduce, when I'm trying to get it done quicker, trying to compress. It's really, the symptom is just uncertainty. I don't have a strong opinion about it. And I've kind of learned that that's artistic death. If you don't have a strong opinion, you probably shouldn't be out that deep. And so part of my process, my learning process, was to say, well, try to confine yourself to things about which you have a strong gut feeling, and then you'll kind of more or less know what to do, and that makes kind of aesthetic certainty. So it's not a choice, really, but maybe it's like the difference between being a sprinter and a shopper. If you're 87 pounds, you're kind of predestined, I guess.
What I found for me, say, in editing, maybe it's the same with you, is sometimes I'll be editing an interview and something won't quite work, and then I'll just remove a Q&A from the middle of it, and suddenly, boom,
exactly,
it works.
Exactly. You know, it's exactly the feeling. And you don't like it, but when you see the resulting leanness, then suddenly you like it. I think that's exactly right. And for me, I always have a feeling like there's some kind of a meter. And as you're reading your own work, you're watching this meter, and you're trying to keep it in the positive red zone. And then for some reason, as you suggested, it'll just, the energy just drops. And in a funny way, you kind of don't even have to know why. I mean, sometimes if you know why, you can fix. But cutting is also a really great option. You just eliminate the nonsense or the kind of sucky parts, and then, you know, what's left is good, is better.
And yet, in this collection, there are a couple of stories that are still very long, like Simplicio Girls and Escape from Reed.
Yeah, but they were longer. Simplicio Girls was at one point arguably 280 pages. I think a story has a DNA that tells you how long it wants to be. And if it's 80 pages, great, but let's not make it a leisurely 80 or a wasteful 80. Whatever its DNA wants to do, make it sit up and do that pretty quickly.
I understand that Simplicio Girls actually kind of originated with a dream.
It did, yeah, yeah. I had a dream, it was a long time ago, but I just dreamed that I went to a window in our house and looked out, and there was a line of those Simplicio Girls in our yard. And the part that was really weird was, in the dream, I wasn't repulsed. I was sort of happy that we had achieved this milestone in our family life. So I've had about 5 dreams in my life that really turned into stories. And that one, I woke up, I thought, oh, man, that's confusing. You know, I don't know what that means. And 12 years later, like magic.
The idea of people being strung by the head, they're being paid to basically be outdoor furniture.
Yeah, yeah. And I never would have thought that up in a million years. I probably would have winced and not written it. But when it comes to you in a dream, it was just fully formed. It was a nighttime scene, and I could smell the lilacs. And so it was kind of like, I think sometimes you just get a little bit of a message from whatever it is, your subconscious or unconscious. And you know, if it's that specific, then I kind of learned to go ahead and take it on faith and see what happens.
How did Simplicio Girl go from that 200-page novel down to, what is it, 30, 40 pages?
Yeah, well, on a lot of my stories, I've noticed this habit, which is I'll get a good start of 15, 20 pages or whatever, and then for some reason, maybe it's just necessary, but I go out and I sow a lot of wild oats. And so in that one, the pages and pages of drafts all start after the victorious birthday party of this girl, Lily. And I just couldn't pick up the thread again. I couldn't figure out what the next beat was. So I would write, you know, 60 or 70 or 80 pages of one thing and then take a couple days off, come back and read it. And just at that juncture, I go, that's not it. It may not have actually gotten to 280 pages, but it's got pretty long until I read it again. And then he thought, no, we still have a problem on page 19 or whatever. So it's kind of frustrating in actuality because you feel like it's right there. You like what you already have. But you just have an obligation to find the next beat that's suitable. And for me, that sometimes means just putting out lots and lots of pages. And then once it's out and kind of polished, I can go, you know, that isn't working. And then sort of slightly turn to myself and say, why do you think it's not working? And ideally, I don't answer myself with a sentence, but with a feeling like, eh. In that story, the big revelation was partly that this story was about the little girl, which I kind of knew at the beginning, you know. But over the trial and error, you become more and more convinced, and then you can execute it.
George Saunders, there is no difference these days between science fiction and literature. There was at one time. I understand that you didn't read much science fiction when you were growing up. None of the old classics?
No, I didn't read much of anything, actually. I had a good year in third grade and then kind of took a break until college, actually. Or maybe a little bit in high school reading, you know, kind of Khalil Gibran or whatever. So I didn't really read. The only thing that I think was strong was seeing, you know, when Star Wars came out. And I remember one particular moment where those ships come over. And they're dented. And that really, you know, that kind of thing gets in. But I was never a big, like, I didn't read, I think I've never read Bradbury, actually, shamefully enough, or Heinlein or any of those guys.
Have you read Philip K. Dick?
Just only in the last year. I went to engineering school, so I really was way behind on reading. Even when I was 22 or 23, I hadn't read really any contemporary fiction at all. Kind of catching up still.
Well, I understand that Slaughterhouse-Five made an impression on you.
It did, but the first impression it made when I was in Asia was kind of, I didn't get it. I didn't get it, partly because I had a bit of an aversion to the sci-fi element of it. And then years later, I kind of pulled head out of ass and understood it.
when you say you had an aversion to it, how'd you get over that aversion?
Actually, by living enough and kind of being compromised enough by life, and then thus experiencing kind of a more complicated emotional palette, and then finding that I couldn't get at those emotions with realism. So to be roughed up a little bit by life, to travel a little more widely out of the country and in the country, and sort of get a feeling for the, you know, the beauties, the complicated contemporary beauties, and then to turn to that new experience with the old realist palette, you could see that the effects weren't obtainable. So it was really just kind of a matter of wanting to expand the power of what I was doing, and then going to sci-fi, going to supernatural, and just kind of as an instinctive move.
An analogy would be when the New York Times starts to read like The Onion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had an experience one time of coming out of a funeral, actually, and it was in a kind of a fake Georgian mansion. And it was as sad a funeral as you could ever imagine. Come out, and then across the street was the Chuck E. Cheese. And the mouse or whatever he is was taking a break. And I thought, isn't that contemporary? You know, the idea that you're experiencing grief that was the same in 1460 and 1890, and here's grief. The contemporary accoutrements of grief happen to be a fake Georgian mansion, a busy thoroughfare, and a guy in a mouse suit. So how do you get that to be both funny, because it's funny, and emotionally powerful? In other words, how do you avoid mere irony, because mere irony in that situation isn't appropriate? So then you start looking for other ways, other rhetorical modes to go into to capture the essence of that very strange but real, you know, contemporary Chuck E. Cheese moment. To me, the experience of living in the world is kind of wonderful and beautiful, and there's so many sensations coming at us that are uncategorizable and coming at us very quickly. So my dream is to try to get some of that into prose. In a split second of observing something, there's a kind of a sensory overload that's preconceptual. And I love the idea that you could, by making the prose strange enough or whatever you want to call it, edgy or whatever, you could get a hint of that feeling, you know, that feeling of sensory overload and a kind of wonder that comes before you say, oh, I'm, you know, in San Francisco, or I'm a guy walking down the street. But there's that split second where you're not sure what you are, and it's pure sensory, you know, input.
Is that part of the reason, maybe I'm going off here, but is that part of the reason that you have your characters in two different stories taking pills which transform them into someone else?
Yeah. Probably it was just looking for some verbal fun, you know, some way to do that, and a drug is a nice way. And then also, I guess, I love the idea that, you know, we think that we're us. We think we're a fixed entity, permanent guy. But, of course, we know even from something as simple as getting a flu or having a toothache that your character somehow is related to your physicality. So I kind of love the idea of just cranking that up a little bit and saying, oh, so you think you're you. You know, let me take this pill and we'll see who you are, you know.
Is that how Spiderhead emerged?
Yeah, it was that thought and then also that impulse. I'd been writing a number of stories that were kind of minimalist, where I would sort of dumb down the prose a little bit. And I was just getting restless about that. And I wanted some excuse to write in the highest register I could. And so I thought, okay, I really want to write something that sounds sort of Henry Jamesian. And I thought, well, all right, how could I do that? Oh, give him a pill. And what's kind of a pill? Well, it's a pill that makes him more articulate. You know, when you're talking about stories, especially after the book is out, there's a tendency to simplify. But my experience is that often a story comes out of two or three simultaneous impulses that aren't really related, but they all seem to be pushing in the same direction. So on that one is this idea of the mutability of the self, and then also the boredom with the prose style. And then something about, you know, the idea of taking a pill. And then they all kind of came together just in a kind of spontaneous, you know, kind of melange.
It isn't exactly as like you're intellectualizing the ideas.
No, not at all. And after the fact, and maybe a little bit as you're doing it, you go, oh, I see what this is. But for my particular brain, it's very important to keep the conceptualizing out and the thematic thinking out as long as possible. Let the natural energy of the story assert itself. And then mysteriously, that stuff seems to happen. But even that has to do more with cleaning up the mess. Like there might be a certain part that's lazy or a certain part that seems the logic blurs. And just by straightening that out, then the theme and all that stuff becomes more assertive. It's kind of a wonderful, strange process that I think you're definitely not in control of. You know, you're curating and you're kind of herding the cats, but something deep is going on and manifesting in the story.
It's kind of turning on the critic, but at the same time, keeping the critic off.
That's exactly right. No, saying, thank you. I value your input, but would you stand outside the barrier, please? And then every so often you might say, come in. Now get out. And it's kind of wonderful because, of course, we contain multitudes, and we contain an inattentive guy and a naysayer and an inner nun, but also a cheerleader and somebody who loves your work too much. And the beauty of kind of working on a story for a long time is that all those different manifestations can come in and have their say. And almost like a really efficient committee, the thing over time will start to be its best self, which is, again, mysterious. But that's really what I put my faith in. I mean, by working in this iterative way, these things happen, and they happen much more efficiently and interestingly than if I was trying to decide in advance.
And you know it's over when suddenly it says to you somehow it's over.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And you've been in it so long that you kind of know, like on some of these stories, there's a section that's free-floating and it's coming in and out of the story. And I say, I want you to stay close, but I don't know where you go yet. And as the subconscious orders the story, suddenly there'll be a rhetorical moment that needs clarification. And that thing that's been around for 4 years will just kind of come in, hook right in there. And my working theory is that the stories kind of exist perfectly in whatever your subconscious say. And in trying to tell it, you drop it and it shatters. And so part of the revision thing is you're just gathering up the shards and putting it back together and then recognizing, oh, this part came out of the wrong place. Like, for example, that chivalric fiasco was originally part of Spiderhead.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But it didn't belong. So I took it out and I thought, well, can I have two stories with drugs? I thought, well, yeah, if it can earn its keep, then we can. And so it sat there for about a year. And then it started, you know, literally started resonating a bit. I thought, oh, so who knows?
It's almost like there's this platonic ideal of that particular story, but it's not quite translating into physical reality. And it's your job to somehow pull it together.
That's exactly it. And it's funny because if you have the faith that that's the case, that gives you a kind of patience. And in time, you just sit there and wait. And you say, you know, you're seem to be missing a limb. And the story will say, no, I'm not. I'm fine. He's not. I don't know. I don't know. And then soon here comes a leg walking up and you attach it and it feels.
I've talked to a number of people who went to Iowa and they talk about the most important thing being voice. And I think the strongest thing in all of your stories is voice. Is that just you're suddenly writing and there it is?
Yeah. Or even maybe slightly reverse, which is I'm not writing and I get the feeling of a voice and I go, oh. And really it's just the feeling that I can do that. I can sustain it. And that is actually, for me, the gateway to everything. If I have that, I feel happy. And I know that the other stuff will arrive. And also the voice will self-modify. If you have something to start with. I had a story called John in the previous book. And it came out of this student was writing a paper about Kafka, an undergrad student. And he had this sentence that said, upon perusing this work of literature, I felt myself at a distinct tilt. And I thought, ooh, that's kind of good. So then, let's try to see if we can write a few paragraphs in that voice. And then the whole story came out. So that's my favorite thing is if I have a voice, then I'm happy. And sometimes failing the voice, you might say, well, let's start with a place. Let's start with a little snatch of dialogue and hope that a voice will take over.
The ending, now I'm not talking about when it's finished, but mm-hmm. The ending of the story, for instance, Semplica Girls kind of ends and you're going, okay, what next?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is deliberate on your part. But did the original story go further?
Yeah, I have a bunch of stuff. The thing is, it's like I have pieces that should go. There is a place where those girls return actually after they were released, and there's a part where we see where they're housed, you know, when they're rejected. And so for me, I think there's a kind of a structural, a cinematic idea that the thing has to keep escalating, and any bit you have has to serve a purpose. If it doesn't serve a purpose, no matter how good it is, it has to come out. So those sections I really like, I still like them, but when I looked at the narrative arc, they just, and anytime I tried to put them in, it was like a goiter. And I had a draft that went on beyond the present mm-hmm. version, but it just felt like some dope trying to cram a bunch of stuff in. So then you say, well, what we're really about is not being funny, not being clever, but being beautifully economical. That's the goal. Everything else has to sort of take a back seat.
Reminds me of, I did this interview the other day with a theater director, and I had a segment where she was talking about Sam Shepard that I loved. Mm-hmm. And I kept trying to put it in different parts of the interview, and it never worked.
Right. That's why they have blog, you know, extra features. But I love that moment, actually, and I'm sure you do too, where you've got a really nice section, but the kind of militant formalist in you says, I'm very sorry, sir, your credentials are flawless, but you don't fit. I think readers feel that too, you know, when you've made a beautiful shape, a beautiful, compelling shape, and as Faulkner said, sacrifice some of your darlings to do it, there's a kind of integrity in that I think produces a good effect in a reader.
At the end of Escape from Spiderhead, which is a science fiction story, it suddenly turns into kind of fantasy because a character dies and keeps going.
Sure. Yeah. Why not? Because I think it would be weird if we didn't in some way. Although we don't know, but I'm kind of interested in the idea that, you know, the humanist notion is that it just so happens that everything that occurs to us habitually and easily is all there is in the universe. which doesn't really make sense. It doesn't make sense that this particular generation should have exactly the right tools to intuit the entire truth of the universe. So who knows? You know, after you die, we, you know, and it's fun for a story to go there, as Dickens found out. Maybe the fun of a story is that it's not life. It's just it's a fun thing. It's me building some stuff with blocks and you looking at it. So in that realm, we should be willing to do anything.
Al Rustin is a story of a self-deluded man from his point of view. On something like that, I mean, how conscious are you in showing the delusions, making it clear to the reader, while keeping it from the characters speaking?
That's exactly the job. And I think it's just line to line. You know, sometimes it's just even a single word difference, you know, that basically it's you and me sitting there looking at him. You're looking to me and I'm providing him with the language. And sometimes just a single word will be enough for me to wink at you a little bit. But at the same time, then there's the other responsibility, which is to not condescend to that poor guy too much, because he's part of this trio also. I mean, the only answer is to me just line to line. You'll poke him a little too hard, and that doesn't feel fair. You got to back it out a little bit. So the whole thing is not conceptual again, but it's just revising the language so that it feels like you're in the right relation to both reader and character. You know?
George Saunders' 10th of December, the story itself, sits a little bit apart from the other stories. It has two strong voices again, but there's an emotional depth there that goes beyond, insofar as I know, most of what you've written before.
That was the last one that I finished that Sumco Girls later, but it was started much earlier. So that to me is the most kind of current of the stories. And it was really a wonderful experience. You know, sometimes you just think, I'm so happy I got to try that, because it was, you know, I think sometimes your art is leading your person. You know, your art is saying, you know, you could be a little more this or you could be a little less that. And in that story, there were places where I could feel myself shedding a certain skin and being a little bit less leery of direct statement, direct emotion. And it was very exciting, you know, and it made me think, well, you know, I could probably now get into a lot of places I couldn't get into 3 or 4 years. Places that I might have felt were too sentimental or too banal, I think I can maybe get into them. And that's, you know, at 54, it's about time, but it's exciting to think that.
The analogy would be the kid breaks through that ice.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So you feel that you've broken through that ice.
It was nothing dramatic, but there was places in that story where in some early drafts I had a bit of a sneer in there. And just in revision, just to reverse that a little bit. And you could feel like it's literally like pulling open a window blind a little bit. So, and then the other thing in that story that happened was there were a lot of very first order, sincere emotions that I haven't in my everyday life that I never have quite been able to get into a story. So there's a bit at the end there where the guy is reflecting on his wife. And I just looked to myself, how would you feel? Boom. And that was thrilling, you know, because then what happens is suddenly sometimes style can be a constraint. You have a certain idea of style and certain things from your life are thereby disincluded. Well, this was a feeling that, wait a minute, maybe I could eventually, not yet, but someday find a style that would include almost everything. And that's really exciting. There wouldn't be anything that you actually felt, saw, or experienced that you couldn't somehow represent in text. And that, to me, would be the long dream. I mean, that's the dream of every writer. But I felt just a little inkling of it in a couple places in that story.
When you're moving in that direction with a short story, you're talking about perfect short stories. You've cited The Overcoat by Gogol.
Yeah, yeah.
I would cite The Dead by James Joyce.
Oh, yeah. It's incredible. And that's a story that's just, you know, I have heard the word used, unobstructed, where there's nothing in God's earth that can't come into the field of play. And that Joyce story certainly has that. Yeah.
George Saunders, there's also a kind of subconscious political element in all of this. Mm-hmm. There's a long article in the New York Times. It mentioned that you had a flirtation early on with Ayn Rand that you got over by traveling the world.
Yeah, I actually wrote a piece for the New Yorker called I Was Ayn Rand's Lover. That was kind of a little tongue-in-cheek. But the truth was, I was in high school and was not applying myself, as they say, and wasn't planning to go to college. And I somehow stumbled upon Atlas Shrugged. And I hadn't read a novel since third or fourth grade and took it on a trip and just loved it. I think mostly because it was long. You know, there were people and there were scenarios. And at that time, I was just getting the sense that because of my, you know, my sloth, I was being left behind. People were getting into colleges. And so something in that book appealed to that wrong sense. The world is, I'm not screwed up. The world is, you know, a vast conspiracy. So I really liked it. But, you know, it's funny, like literature, writers have these tropes about the good things that literature does do. does. Yeah. But that book, which I think now is a terrible bit of propaganda, but at the time, the only thing it did for me was it made me feel like an intellectual. I felt like I had tapped into some kind of Eastern European intellectualism. And I remember very clearly closing the book in the backseat of a friend's car and having this extended fantasy about being in college. And it was sort of like something out of a 1930s movie. Like I had a letter sweater and maybe one of those big megaphone, but surrounded with my friends, and we were talking about ideas. So that was really the, as they say, the takeaway from that book was that maybe I too could participate in some kind of intellectual life. So after that, I applied to colleges and got in. So as much as I now disdain her, I also kind of, you know, grateful that she got me into college and also made a terrible monstrosity of my nation through her ideology. So it's a kind of a trade-off.
This is a great quote. I actually wrote it down here. This is from Paul Krugman. There are two novels that can change a bookish 14-year-old life, The Lord of the Rings and Atlas Shrugged. One is a childish fantasy that often engenders a lifelong obsession with its unbelievable heroes, leading to emotionally stunted, socially crippled adulthood, unable to deal with the real world. And the other, of course, is about orcs.
Yeah, that's fantastic. No, I think that whole idea, I mean, there's something in that, in Rand that's really appealing to young people, and some of us, you know, grew out of it. And for me, the growing out happened just by having the world point out the flaws in her logic. You know, I went to Asia and worked there and saw a lot of people who were suffering, and there was no way you could pin it on their whining or their lack of trying. And so I, you know, to my credit, I was not lunk-headed enough to persist long in that. And I think most people who know people who have suffered or been poor or failed, including themselves, would see that the Rand system doesn't quite hold up.
When you're writing essays, do you look at an essay the same way that you would look at a piece of fiction?
Not really. For me, the relief of writing the essays, especially the sort of travel pieces, is just that the story is there. I don't have to do this long searching for plot. The basic events are there, and then it's a matter of trying to see which one of them actually writes well, and then that'll tell you about structure. But that, for me, that's a quicker process and kind of a more, I don't know if it's not really more pleasant, but it's sort of more businesslike in a certain way. You know, you go on a trip and you think, those seven things have potential, and they happen in chronological order, so probably they'll be written that way. And then you just start trying to write each little pod, and some of them go to dust, and some of them blow up, and some that you didn't really think would write well do. And then, you know, it's a 12,000 word limit. So depending on what you have, you start sort of shuffling the Rubik's Cube a little bit. And then, interestingly, both the story and the theme come out of which bit has the most muscle. And then by lining those up, and strangely, once you do that, that thing looks a lot like your actual experience, you know. So, but it's more, kind of more editing, and then also getting a section that's, you got a 700 word section. Yeah, well, that's not going to work because it's only 12,000 total. So that's got to come down to about a third. And so it felt a little more like tech writing used to feel for me. You could sort of just work with the text in a kind of almost mathematical way, and which I really enjoy.
But you also have the opportunity, number one, it's your voice.
Yeah.
Right. Number two, you have an opportunity to be overt in your political ideas, as opposed to the stories here where the political ideas are there, but they've come in through the same back door as the story.
Right. And I actually prefer the story route, because then you have the liberty of not being sure what your political belief is and anchoring it in an objective reality in an individual person, which to me is much more profound. If you say, I really don't know how I feel about X, let me start telling you the story about Ted, and Ted becomes a human being, what might be merely political becomes fully personal. That seems to me deeper. Whereas in the story, the nonfiction pieces, you do have an idea. And what I tend to do is just sort of confess. Here's how I think I feel. Now let's go into the field and see what happens. And the overturning or complicating of that idea is good. For me, as I'm getting older, fiction is deep. It's something I really just am in love with, you know. And the nonfiction, I like it a lot. I love the trips that you get to take and all that. But my heart is really in fiction.
You know, maybe this is glib to say that nonfiction is about answers and fiction is about questions.
I think that's exactly. Chekhov said, you know, fiction doesn't have to solve problems. It just has to formulate them correctly. And I think that's true.
Bert Saunders, in 2006, in an interview in Guernica, you said you'd written a couple of screenplays. Were those the screenplays for Winky and Redbubble?
No, I wrote Civil War Land script for Ben Stiller, which is still kind of bouncing around. And then I wrote one for a story called Sea Oak for a director called Kier MacFarlane. That is also kind of bouncing around. And I think the ones you talked about, I think those were student films that someone else did with permission.
I was thinking in reading some of your interviews that you've talked a lot, I guess in your classes when you're teaching, about trying to not form judgments about writing. Yeah. Do you think trying to be a critic could throw you off if you did try that?
It could throw me off because I came to writing from a strange place and I'm not really that well read. So I don't think I have the guns for it. I don't have the training or the reading background. Psychologically, I'm a very harsh critic in my mind, you know, in the way that I think you have to be if you're an artist. But I don't really want to export those things. I mean, it's almost too harsh. It's sort of like you're just ripping through books to see what you can use. You know, you read somebody great like Tolstoy and you say, okay, is there anything else that needs to be done? And that kind of real aggressive criticism. But it's just something that doesn't interest me. I've got a character flaw, which is I really don't like criticizing. So if I had to write a bad review, I would feel I hurt his feelings. So I don't have the backbone to really do it in a responsible way.
On the other hand, you have no problem in any of your stories having your characters be very, very critical.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, because in a story, it's a sort of a platonic criticism of something, and it's idealized. And then and then somebody like me who's fundamentally dishonest can be really honest in a fictive mode. But even in those GQ pieces, when I would have to, you know, run up against a real dope, I just couldn't quite, you know, I couldn't quite say it. I always felt a little bit like, and maybe that's a good thing, because even a dope has redeeming qualities.
George Saunders, how many stories do you generally have going at the same time that you're sort of working on?
Usually it's four or five, and then I finish about two a year. So the four or five are just sort of on the desk, and then one thing I've developed is if I go out to this little shed and write, and if sort of just say, well, which one of you guys is going to be fun? You know, any of you guys have any joy in you, or, you know, and if one of them feels fun, then I'll work on it. And at some point, one will start to surge ahead and need to be finished, and I'll concentrate on that one. It's not true now, but from now back until 1988, I haven't had an empty desk, which is kind of a trick to not have to confront the blank page.
Have you thought about writing a play?
I have written a play, a really stupid one no one will ever see. So I did think about it, and I tried it. You know what? I kind of realized, because I used to be a songwriter when I was in high school and college. I'm a pretty good guitar player, not bad. I think the thing that stories have for me is I really love them. I've loved them since the first day I read Hemingway. And I just want to be in that lineage so much. And anything else, I kind of wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind being a playwright. I wouldn't mind being a songwriter. I actually wouldn't mind being a novelist, but I really want to be a story writer. So I think when you talk about taking your art to the very highest, you know, weirdest ledge on the side of the building, you have to really not only want it, but I think you have to put in just thousands of hours of doing it. So I noticed when I was screenwriting, I was all right, you know, but I wasn't that 17-year-old kid who was idolizing screenwriters, and I didn't put in thousands of hours doing it. So I think, you know, you get to a certain point in your writing life and you just want to only do the stuff that is precious to you. And right now, the story is number one.
When you were much younger, I know that you've said that I'm going to do Carver, I'm going to do Hemingway, I'm going to do this person, I'm going to do that person. These days, are you able to read other people's short stories and then your own voice is strong enough to go, fine, I'm not them, I'm not going to worry about that?
I think so. Yeah, and it's funny because I don't really know how or when that happened, but now what will happen is I'll read Carver or Hemingway or whoever and just feel kind of a reawakened belief in the power of language. Okay, so this is all fun. And then you go and you do your own thing. It's almost like if you saw a beautiful performance, and that made you want to go do some other kind of performance. The voice seems to be kind of on its own at this point.
You also teach writing, and you've said that it's fine even for non-writers because you're trying to work through craft issues, ego, and worldview issues.
Yeah. My working hypothesis is that anybody who really wants to do it should do it, and that the process of doing it is somehow a dignified thing. And even if you aren't that good, if you take a piece of prose and it goes from being a 2 to a 6, in the process of doing that, you've had to confront some of your stuff, whatever it is. Maybe it's you know, language level issues, or maybe it's avoidance issues, or so that's kind of a new age view, and I think I'm right about it. But at Syracuse, it's not really an issue because these students are so, you know, we get 600 or so apps a year and 6 people come, so they're good already, they're great already. And I think in the larger culture, there's a lot of writers, a lot of people trying to get in MFA programs, and I think generally that's a good thing. You know, when I was a kid, I was in my 20s, kind of floundering. I was in Chicago, and I went to see a friend, and he wasn't there, but his dad was there. And his dad, we got to talking, and I had this harebrained scheme at the time. I wanted to go to El Salvador and write the great El Salvadoran war novel. Didn't speak Spanish, didn't have any money, didn't have a typewriter, but, you know. So I told him this, and he was real sweet about it. And he said, well, you know, my opinion is if you got a dream, you got to do it. I said, yeah, yeah. He said, because you know who you'll blame if you don't. I said, yeah, of course, myself. He said, you'll blame your wife and kids. So I always think, you know, for my students, if you really want to do this thing in your 20s, try it. And even if you fail, as you go on in your life, you'll have the consolation of knowing that you gave it your best shot. And I think you're the better for it. I think. I don't think writing in and of itself is, yeah, it's good or bad, whatever. But if a person has that kind of, almost like a destiny, like some, like I've always wanted to be really good at something since I was a little kid. I can remember being one of my earliest memories. So if you feel that way, or like I always wanted attention as a kid, I just did. So if you feel that way, you can either deny it, which seems like a boneheaded thing, or you can say, well, I don't know why, but I kind of do. So let me try to burn that off. You know, go directly towards the object of your desire. You've got to be the better for it if you try to burn that stuff off and get to the next higher thing.
George Saunders, in 2006, in an interview, you were asked about how optimistic you were about the future, and granted, that was still during the George Bush years, yet you were fairly optimistic. When looking at our future now, given that we're 7 years later along global warming, we've got a Democrat in the White House, but we've got drone attacks and an increased national security state, what are you seeing?
Well, kind of two answers, because yes, yeah, you know, we're but on the other hand, you know, I guess the maybe as you get older, there's kind of a feeling that, you know, that what there was a quote at the beginning of a Tom McGuane book, and it said, man is wonderfully well made and enthusiastically lives the life that is being lived. So I kind of feel like, yes, if by any objective standards we're going down the pipe. And yet, you know, if you look at the individual, there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of wonderful things to be done, even if we're going down the pipe. What I try to be is not optimistic or pessimistic, because both those stances are engaged in rounding off data. You know, if I say everything's great and it's always going to be great, you're like, yeah, no, let me drive a spike through your head and see if, you know. But if you say, oh, everything is just, and then someone gives you a birthday cake, you know, or someone makes love to you. So I think for me, the desired position is to be sort of a data receptor who's not particularly pre-inclined to be happy or sad. Just what is it? And incidentally, I think that attitude is probably the one that would get us out of trouble the most. If people would really say, well, regardless of how I feel about global warming, it is happening. Regardless of what my politics tells me I should feel, it is happening. Then action would take place faster. So optimists, pessimists, to me, are almost like they're two sides of the same coin, you know.
I once interviewed Jan Morris and asked her about, you know, she's a great travel writer, and I asked her about what's happening in the world. This was like 20 years ago. Her comment was, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I could think of is, well, it always is.
It always is. I mean, I get also, too, maybe the way to think of it for me is, if you wanted to be energetic and powerful and loving and of use, then what's the most effective way to think? To think, in my experience, that disempowers a person. If you're always, oh, God, then you have no energy. But also to be falsely manically optimistic is a drain. So I just try to think, well, okay, so let's not be too in a rush to judgment. Watch your own energy. How does your energy thrive? In what state? And for me, it's to be a little bit happy, and also not hypnotized. You know, that's kind of the way in which I seem to have the most energy. And by extrapolation, if there's anything good to be done, that state would do it. And probably it's local. You know, you think about getting through a day without doing anything thoughtless. I can't do it without hurting anybody's feelings. Maybe, I guess basically I'm kind of happy. One of the ideas that I love is that there's sort of the absolute, which is, well, the world's going to end someday, and it looks like it might be sooner rather than later, although maybe we'll rally. I hope we will. But then there's the relative, which is here we are having a nice talk in a nice room. And so you're kind of a fool if you discount either of those things. You know, it is true that there's a lot of big, sad things going on. It's also true that in the short term, this is nice. And so why not let both of those things kind of sit there in your mind together?
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with the Magic Theater in San Francisco. Okay. That's where Sam Shepard started out.
Oh, okay.
And they're still doing a lot of very interesting work. I do theater interviews. I was interviewing the artistic director. And all of her plays this year are family plays. Mm. And I was thinking, but wait a second. A few years ago, they were all political plays. Mm-hmm. What is going on?
These stories they're very familial. And for me, I can give you a kind of embarrassing answer, but the last book of essays and the book of stories, the politics were just on my shoulders because of the war and everything. Some good came out of it, and some, I had a feeling of being a little shrill and a little surficial. So in this book, I kind of And then maybe a sort of relief, oh, our guy's in the White House, so now we can back down, which isn't actually true, but you can do it. So I kind of felt myself saying, wow, that was really confusing, and I didn't particularly like being in that place. I felt like I was on thin ice all the time with all my opinionating and stuff. So to retreat to what felt to me like a more classic idea of the story, which is family, people, love, hate, that felt really, really good. And in the end, I think, as you sort of alluded earlier, those stories can have political feeling, or I would say moral ethical feeling, but I think that can sometimes feel more earned. It feels like not so agenda driven. And so I really kind of like that retreat. And I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't sort of maybe a cultural reaction to the way that we were all up on our toes during the Bush years, you know.
There's an interview with you in Slate where you're talking to your editor. On these stories in particular, how valuable is the editor at this point for you?
Really valuable. Actually, the Tempico Girl stories wouldn't be in there without Andy Ward. I actually sold the book without that in there. I had been struggling with it for 12 years, and I kind of felt a little bit embarrassed by it, and I just kind of spilled my guts to him. And he's got just a great spirit. He said, let's try it. Just send it to me. And somehow just that tone, like, oh, and I sent it, and he was like, this is really good. Keep going, keep going. And then in the end, he gave me a great edit of the long version of the stories, and also the ordering of the stories and kind of the whole ethos of the way we were going to present it. He led the way on that. The stories have all been edited for The New Yorker, but then there's an editing for the book. He edited all those GQ stories that I did. And on every one of those, you know, I'd be in some far-flung place, a little confused. What should I do? Should I do this? And he would just say, here's what you do. And it was always kind of the most positive, generous vision of the story. So we've gotten really close, and I hope my editor for life, because he's the real deal.
10th of December. Why that title?
Just the sound of it. That was really, I wanted it to be in the winter, and I just liked those words, you know, in terms of like titles of stories or names of characters. I really don't like that move where you name somebody Mr. Hubris. that seems to me like an old fashioned thing. So if I can get a name that is sort of not metaphorical, I like that. Not metaphorical, that sounds good.
And how many stories you have now waiting?
Now zero. Well, I have one. I have one that I don't know what it is, but that's my only lifeline, is one little, you know, 16-page thing that's
really
there. Yeah, because I really took, after this book, I took a big break.
Are you concerned about the fact that there's only the one?
No, because that's one. My plan, you know, I'm 54, and the plan for pretty much the rest of my life is to try to be as secluded as I can. And so you just start that one, and it'll drop off two or three other stories. And, you know, I'm not in a rush. This book took 7 years, you know, so I'm not in any big rush at all.
What about essays?
I think I'm off that for a while. I'm really with this book, I got on a roll. I stopped doing everything but fiction for about, I would say probably, you know, 4/5 of this book. And I could just feel the stories get energized because they were the only focus. So I think I'm going to just try to do that for a while. And just, you know, God knows it's a lot, you know, but just to say whatever, you know, energy I have for writing or urge to get attention, I'm going to say, okay, you're welcome, but you have to do it through the mode of the short story. And I think it gives them more power.
Also, if you have a novel, you have a deadline, and that is death for a short story.
Yeah. Deadlines, and I don't agree. I'm Catholic, and so as soon as there's a deadline, I get panicky. So, there's something really liberating in just saying it'll be ready when it's damn well ready, and I'll wait. I can wait, you know. And then the stories, it's almost like they're sort of like a pet. Once they see that you're serious, they'll kind of get in line and start behaving.
You've been listening to an interview with George Saunders, whose new collection of short stories is titled 10th of December. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.